Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize, pediatric speech-language pathologist.
Hi, Laura. This is Kate Hensler. I'm a developmental interventionist, and I don't know why I always add with the First Steps program here in Louisville, Kentucky. How are you tonight?
I'm really good. How are you?
You know how I am. I'm really hurting. I don't want to be complaining about this. Oh, we worked. Our whole family worked. Are you there?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you meant worked so hard cleaning our old house, and somehow I managed to do it, but today there isn't a muscle in my body. It hurt to put the spray on my hair after I took a shower. That's how sore.
Oh, no.
Yes, and I've been taking Advil all day, and I can't say it's helped all that much. So hopefully tomorrow's a new day, because it's going to be really hard to work in this condition.
I was going to say, you better have some kind of miracle happen overnight, or it's going to be hard to play on the floor all day tomorrow.
Oh, I know. It's been really weird. I mean, I guess I just, you know, I got really excited and not so into it, but motivated.
Yeah.
And I did, literally, we worked there. Bill did longer than I did, but, of course, he's in better shape. So he's sore, but nothing like I am. And I worked there for probably 11 and a half hours, just cleaning,
cleaning.
The very first thing I did was move the couch with Bill from the basement up the very steep driveway into the front of the house. I should have known after that it was all downhill. But anyway, enough about me. I'm great. I'm just getting older and a little sore tonight. So.
Oh,
but I'm ready for
a
podcast.
I hope you feel better.
I will.
Yeah, I think tonight's going to be a fun show. I have some announcements first. First of all, Johnny and I are so saddened by all the floods. And have you been seeing that on the news, especially down south in Louisiana? And we had such a good time when we were in Louisiana in December in Baton Rouge and New Orleans. And we're just thinking about our friends there and hoping that they aren't sustaining any damage. And so I wanted to mention that. This is a huge week for me because the new book comes out tomorrow. Yay! Kind of like my version of your house saga, since I've started talking about it and kind of conceptualizing it. Oh, about a year ago when you started your house.
The first labors of love, yes.
Yes, and I've really done very little of anything else since Christmas other than work really hard on this book. There's not been a day in this whole time, really more than a day or so, that I didn't work on it. So I'm so excited that it's when the word count, we got the word count, and it was over 100,000 words, and Johnny was really like, oh my gosh, that's a whole lot. That's a lot. So that's a lot, even for me, Miss Chatty me. So it's right at 240 pages, and I'm so excited about it. And the pre-sales have just been phenomenal, and those books will ship tomorrow. But there's still time if anyone has a coupon code that they have not used. That expires tonight at midnight, and it is a firm, hard deadline. It's already programmed into the system, so please use your coupon code by tonight if you wanted to get that big, big savings on that. But I'm so excited that comes out tomorrow, and we're going to be using some of that information tonight to talk about the question that we're going to answer tonight. But before we do that, I'll also be in Tennessee this week, and if you live in Tennessee and want to come to the conference, I'd love to have you. You can get registration information at my website at teachmetotalk.com. And then the last thing I want to mention before we get going here is our two Facebook links that I put on today on teachmetotalk.com's page, and they were so interesting. Did you look at those, Kate? Did you get a chance to look at that one about autism?
I saw the link, and I think maybe I went there, but to be honest, I must not have spent much time because it didn't leave much impression. Remind me, and maybe it'll come back to me.
You're exhausted. You're just exhausted. It was from, it's from Autism Speaks, from their blog.
Oh, I did see it, whether it's intervention or prevention.
Prevention, yeah, with children with autism.
You just had to start talking about it, and it came back to me.
Yeah, the post is about, it's from the International Meeting for Autism Research that's going on right now. I think it's in London, but I'm not exactly sure. And the person is just talking about all of the new information that researchers have uncovered in the last year or so about parent-directed intervention strategies, meaning that, lots of researchers, and the program that comes to my mind is UC, the Mind Institute at UC Davis, and I've posted a lot of their links and followed that really closely because so much of the stuff that they're doing and researching are the things that we do every day, working with really, really young babies and toddlers. And, you know, they're in California and, again, on the cutting edge of everything. And so they have really spent lots of time looking at children that are 6 months to 12 months old who have siblings who have been diagnosed with autism and really studying and training parents and then measuring later the kind of the severity ranges of the children who do go on to be diagnosed with autism and looking at the children that showed red flags for autism really early and whether those ever developed. And they're trying to make some correlations between whether parent intervention can actually prevent an autism diagnosis or whether it just lessens the severity or kind of what that is. One study that came out earlier said that it didn't really have an impact. And I'm glad that I didn't read that study because that's really sad to me that there would be, you know, basically to me that would be like saying, it doesn't matter what you do, you're not going to be able to make it any better. But thankfully they've had studies since then that have that they've been able to clarify and say that parent interaction and training parents and interventions that we put in place when children are toddlers really do seem to have an effect on at least the severity level of children who go on to be diagnosed with autism, meaning that they're higher functioning. They communicate in higher levels. And so to me, again, I haven't read the specific studies, but that would mean that they talk and that they understand language and use language functionally. So again, it's good information. And really, to me, it's so inspiring because it means what we're doing in the field really works. And all the efforts that we put into parent training and even working with toddlers directly so that parents can see what we do and how to do it really does affect those children's lives and those families' lives. So I'm so excited to read that, and I wanted to pass that along. Now that I've blabbed on for 5 straight minutes about that, what did you think about that article, Kate?
Well, it made me kind of, again, kind of gave me added or additional or renewed faith in what we do.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I so totally think, and that's one of the problems with kind of what we do, and I'm not anyway, particularly empirical sometimes about
right.
collecting data and really researching. I mean, it's like you know and the parents know that kids are making progress and that we do have significant influence on how they look, at least by the time they're 3, but we don't really have studies per se to to document that. Also kind of made me think sometimes I wish we were a little bit more progressive here in identifying kids early on. We still have quite a few pediatricians out there who are telling parents not to worry. He's not even 2 yet. And by the time, you know, they begin to worry and get referred to us, they're 2.5. And we've missed a lot of valuable time. But, I mean, better late than never, and I always feel that way, but sometimes I do think, what was your pediatrician thinking? You know, I just don't think we're not quite as progressive. California is always kind of a trendsetter, and they are in this case in a good way. I wish sometimes there are a few very progressive pediatricians locally that refer. You know, they ask the right questions, they get the answers, and they make early referrals. And I think that's always to the child's benefit and the family's benefit as a whole. So that's what I thought.
Yeah, I think as a whole, our area, we certainly have those kids that get late referrals. I mean, that happens everywhere, but we get a lot of earlier referrals, too. The thing that's happened with our system, though, is going to that new level of screening where they use the ASQ to ask parents those questions, and sometimes children aren't getting, and they don't even make it to that initial evaluation level.
A new issue. It used to be
every child's
evaluation, and one could hope that in most cases they were identified or there was some concern and they'd be referred. At this point, they have somebody asking questions over the phone, and some parents, frankly, even if they answer accurately, sometimes kids who are on the spectrum, because they may have some splinter skills or because whatever, they may not be flagged, and really they should be. And I think if somebody, an examiner, were there who was qualified to do the eval, would see those kids, they'd probably have some concerns. But over the phone, with, you know, it's pretty hard to share those things. So,
well, and I'm getting a lot of those emails because, thankfully, the people that work in our intake system have so graciously embraced the website and the DVDs as an education tool. And, you know, they ordered some DVDs early on, and when they disappeared from the Loon Library, I've just been replacing those. I know, but I've been replacing those. And so I know that they're getting, you know, I'm getting emails from parents who are watching those and from parents who are saying, my child didn't qualify, but the person told me about your website, and, you know, they'll ask me other questions, and I'm able to hook them up with other community resources if they need it, or just kind of talk them through what they should look at on the website and the DVD. So that's been good, and I feel like, well, at least we're not just leaving folks high and dry and saying, you didn't qualify, good luck to you. And I don't know that that's not happening, but I love that I'm getting some emails that where parents are really kind of going that extra mile and looking for that information. So I'm excited about that. But I did want to say, if the main reason I'm mentioning this here on the show tonight is so that if therapists are listening or parents and you want to take a look at that yourself, it's on TeachMeToTalk.com's Facebook page. And if you're not a Facebook person, you can still get there by going to the regular website, TeachMeToTalk.com, and then down in the bottom right-hand corner, there's a place for you to see the Facebook post, and you can click on there and get there and take a look at that information for yourself. So wanted to pass that along. The other cool link from today is from spdfoundation.net. It's the Sensory Processing Disorders Foundation, and it is a cute handout for parents, grandparents, and teachers to introduce what sensory processing differences look like. Kate, I don't think I sent you that one, did I?
No, I want to have to check it out. I always kind of find that a little bit difficult to discuss, so that would be helpful.
Well, this is so cute because there's a line drawing of a little girl and a little boy, and so it's just, you know, I love cute little art like that anyway. And it says, you know, I'm prone to that with my little budding artist. My daughter here at home draws things like that all the time, and, you know, she's done our logos and things, so it reminded me of Macy's work. But it's really cute because it points to the child's eyes, and it says something like, I'm trying to pull it up, but of course my computer is slower than Christmas right now. Mm-hmm. But it says, you know, I might shield my eyes from direct sunlight or blink a lot. And so it really takes all of those characteristics, and like it points to the little line points to the child's mouth, and it says, I may not like new textures or trying new foods. And so it takes sensory processing differences and really kind of humanizes and gives a parent what they would look for or what they would notice about their kid in real-life language rather than, he's demonstrating all sensitivities, blah, 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 that, you know, people have no earthly idea of what you're talking about unless you're a therapist. So I just thought it was the cutest little tool that therapists could use with parents, or if parents are trying to explain sensory processing to grandparents who might just be saying, well, if you would just make him eat that food, or if you wouldn't feed him anything else, or any of those little quirks that our kids have, it might be a better way to explain it, or even just open up a conversation about that with someone who might not be as familiar. I think it would also be a really good tool to use with daycare teachers and preschool teachers who might not have much exposure to sensory processing differences. So that's on there. Take a look at that. It's really cute. I think you'll like it a lot. Okay, let's get to our question. And we actually had this flagged for last week, but we didn't get to it. Imagine that. And so this is from a speech pathologist named Leslie, and she has written me a couple of different times, so I immediately recognized her name. And she says, I'm an SLP. I'm working with almost a two-year-old boy. He understands everything and seems to know the names of many items in his environment. He says the words with the correct vowel sound. So she's identified that he's talking and he's naming specific things, but he has no consonants. He only has vowels. She said he really points to get his needs met. The only word I've heard him say correctly is mom. Otherwise, he uses no consonant sounds, only vowels. I have taught him to sign please and more. She said I've only seen him three times. So that's good. She's gotten two signs in three visits. That's really, really good. She said I've tried some animal sounds, but he will not imitate me. Any ideas of how to get him to progress from grunting? And this is a pretty common referral for us to get in early intervention. Can you think of lots of children that sound like that kid?
I'd say 95% of the kids on my caseload, ding, ding, ding. Yep, seen him a bunch of times. Yes,
I know.
Very common.
I know. So she's done what's great at the beginning with getting him another way to communicate that, because it probably is pretty darn hard for him to make his needs known with just vowels. And so for you moms that are listening that are not quite sure what I'm talking about, so if he wants a cookie, he might say or he might even say or something, but he doesn't have the k sound at the beginning or the middle to let you know what he's really saying. If he were trying to say book, he might also say oh. So his mom, if she's not really in tune with him, she might not know, okay, does he mean cookie? Does he mean book? Does he mean foot? Does he mean anything with that sound? So it could be really, really challenging to live with a little guy like this. What complicates it even further is he's got great receptive language, or at least good, she said. So at some point, he's going to probably realize, hey, my mommy's not getting this. And that is almost, I mean, I love it when a kid comes to us with intact social skills and intact receptive language, because I feel like, gosh, half the battle's already won there. You know, we don't have as much work to do. But it's almost, those kids get a little bit more frustrated sometimes because they know that someone should be understanding them and responding. Have you had that experience too, Kate, where you almost feel more sorry for those little kids because they realize on some level, man, this is hard. This is not supposed to be this difficult.
Yeah, they are a little bit more with it as far as what you're working on and what your expectations are and what the demands are. And sometimes they can be a little tougher nut to crack than those who are not quite as with it cognitively. Yep, they know, all right. And I always tell the mom, it's really hard for him. It's really hard. I'm asking him to do something that's very difficult for him to do, you know, which is one of the rationales for why you better keep it fun, because it's hard, you know, it's hard for him to do. So, anyway.
So she's saying, how do we get him to progress from grunting? So, you know, and again, how many times have you done an initial evaluation, Kate, where you ask a mom, is he talking? And she says, well, he can grunt and he can point to let me know. And thank goodness he has those compensatory strategies, or mom would probably really feel at a loss. You know, it's great that he can indicate some of his wants and needs with punting, pointing and vocalizing. But she's saying, how can I make him move on from this? And this information that we're going to talk about is something that I talk about in conferences in my early speech language development, taking theory to the floor. And it's certainly something that, from a theoretical standpoint, lots of therapists have stored this information somewhere in their clinical brains. But trying to put it all together is really hard for a lot of therapists. It's really hard for them to not look at a kid who's grunting and doing just vowel sounds and not panic a little bit, like, uh-oh, what am I going to do now? And it sounds like she's already started really modeling and really trying to give him real simple patterns to imitate, because she did another great thing when she started with animal sounds. You know, so she immediately thought, okay, I can't go straight for these traditional words like more and milk and bubble and go and all of our kind of standard go-to things. So she thought, I better back him up a little bit. And he still wasn't able to imitate what she described as simple animal sounds. So what do you do with a kid like that? And again, we're going to walk through the process of teaching a kid how to imitate verbally. And so you can't, when you have a kid like this, again, if you've tried the regular words and you've tried some of those simpler words, you got to back further up than that as kind of your starting point. And so you really want to look to see if a child like this can start to imitate some gestures. And for this little guy, we would know that answer would be yes, because she's taught him to sign please, and she's taught him to sign more in just a couple of sessions. So that was a super start for him. So she knows he can motorically imitate her. And that's important, because lots of our kids that we get can't do that, can they, Kate?
No. I mean, just even the simplest, whether it be more or please or waving or pointing with an index finger, clapping, raising their hands up. I mean, and then when they begin to, those kids who couldn't initially, you see how far their approximations are from what you're modeling. You think, wow. Wow, no wonder you couldn't do it, you know.
Yeah, no wonder you're not talking yet, because, because you can't even really imitate a motor movement yet. So with kids like this, you do have to, and kids, again, who are not quite even where this little boy is, you have to start way back at the beginning. I kind of think about, okay, I'm starting at square one with this kid, with looking at if the toddler can imitate really early, simple motor movements. And we've already talked about a couple of those. Clapping. Can he clap when you clap? And isn't it sometimes when we see a little guy who he might even clap and he doesn't even really get his hands together? Have you noticed kids like that before, Kate, that you think, man, that you are not even really able to bring both your hands to midline in a really rhythmical, coordinated way? And I have certainly seen some awkward little clappers.
But boy, and even if they do that, you're happy to see it at the beginning. Like, woohoo, progress.
Yeah.
He's doing it.
But that is what you look at and you think, well, no wonder you're not talking yet, because you're having trouble with really basic motor movements. And speech really is still a motor movement. You're sending those same messages from your brain to your mouth, just like you would for sending messages to your little legs to pedal a bike. You know, speech is still a motor skill on some level. So we start
the ultimate motor movement.
Yeah,
really. When you think about all the things that have to coordinate to get.
It's a wonder any of us learn to talk, isn't it?
It is. You're right. Well, and it's so automatic for most people, and then for kids with motor problems, you see, wow, it's really not automatic at all for them.
Right. And so we start with those really simple actions like clapping, like waving. Some kids don't know that when mommy and daddy walk into their rooms and that they're waiting to be picked up from the crib, you know, you'll look at a typically developing baby who's 6 months, 7 months, 8 months old. What happens when mom walks in the room to pick him up? Mom sticks her hands out, and then he automatically reaches his hands up to her, and his arms are up like, pick me up, pick me up. And some of our little guys that we get that aren't imitating or using any gestures aren't doing that. So we start looking at those things or those motor skills that a typically developing baby would have acquired between 6 months and 12 months, and we work at that level to help our little friends learn how to do that. Other kind of motor things that you could imitate there, what are some other ones you have kids do, Kate? I'm putting you on the spot. I should have sent you the handout. I'll just kind of talk through some, and you just jump in whenever you want
okay.
to. Things like stomping your feet, things like imitating, you know, I'll try to get a kid to run with me or walk with me or jump with me. But sometimes a lot of our little guys can't jump because jumping is really a 24-month-old motor skill. And I've had a lot of kids that are still really almost anchored to the floor, even, you know, 2.5, 3, because they're older or because their motor skills have been so impacted that they're still not great jumpers yet. But every once in a while you'll get a kid whose motor skills, that fine motor, has more trouble imitating than he would maybe a gross motor thing like jumping or running. Or kicking is a big one, kicking a ball. I don't have a ton of balls in therapy, but I use balloons all the time and really try to get my little clients to kick the balloons with me because they think that's a lot of fun. Kicking is a pretty complex motor movement for some kids. Have you had kids, Kate, who were awkward kickers? We were talking about awkward clappers. Yeah, yeah. And I'll think, ooh, please don't fall.
Bubbles, that's another one that I always do early on because so many kids love bubbles. And so many of the kids, at least in the beginning, it's almost like they can't track them, but they certainly aren't able to reach and pop them. But then if you hold it for them on the little wand in front of them, sometimes they can get it that way. But, you know, otherwise they just kind of sit there and think, couldn't pop that if my life depended on it. And they don't really try.
Uh-huh. You know, and I really start with popping bubbles with having kids take their whole hand and smack the floor when it's landed on the floor because I think that's a lot easier. And again, I want him to pop the bubble because that's functional and that's a fun thing in play. But my thing is I want him to imitate motor movements. So if I have him doing big smacks on the floor, I'm almost happier about that because, again, he's been able to copy a motor movement and do that. Sometimes kids can't copy movements with their own bodies, like patting their heads or rubbing their tummies or touching their noses or raising their arms or anything like that because they can't really see their body parts to do that, and their bodies are still so uncoordinated and they have those kind of limited awareness skills and coordination skills. So you have to start with motor imitation with a toy because then they can see the action with the toy. And so some common things that you might try, maybe pushing a car. You would think about what are the logical things that a kid would first do with a toy. So rolling a car, stacking blocks, banging on a drum with either your hands or a drumstick. That would be a good thing to do. We've already talked about popping bubbles. Knocking on a door is something, a door of a toy, or lots of our, even toys that don't have real doors. Don't you have kids try to knock on that anyway before they open it?
Yes, and I do lots of knocking even if there isn't really a door. It's almost like, depending on my mood, if something's inside of something, I could knock on anything. And kids, that's just one of those kind of universal things kids seem to really like.
Yeah.
So, if you know, in a dull moment, I'm likely to knock on just about anything. And I've had a lot of kids at least imitate the knock, and sometimes they'll try and say knock, knock, knock. So
they will, yeah. So that's a good one to try. And again, anything that a kid would logically do with your object. So with our ball toy with a hammer, that's certainly something an early toy I would be trying. And again, sometimes kids, it's funny, they won't know how to use the hammer. It'll be really kind of almost uncomfortable or uncoordinated, and we'll turn it around every different way before I'm reaching over and hand over hand.
Like this, yo. I mean, normally it doesn't take too long, but I've had a handful where it took so long. You know, I wanted to send up rockets when they finally got that hammer and pounded, like, woohoo!
Yeah.
And we worked and worked and worked and worked to get them just to do that.
Well, and that's pretty advanced. I mean, that's an OT or, you know, would look at that and say, okay, that's tool use. That may be even a step above, you know, rolling the car or popping the bubble. But I like to do that early on with kids. It is funny to me, the kids that will kind of throw the hammer down and just start pushing with their hands, and I think, oh, that was good problem solving. You couldn't figure out how to do it with your hammer. So you went straight for the hand, which was, you know, again, I'm thinking, okay, he's thinking, he's solving some problems cognitively here. He's trying to figure out how can I get the ball in that hole if I can't make this stupid hammer work. So that's another thing that, that you would try is kind of looking at that with the kid. And again, that's kind of a side note to what we're talking about, but I like to see that when that happens. Other common things that you might try with actions, you know, maybe a pretend phone to his ear. I think now all our, I remember, you know, when I first started working, we didn't have cell phones, you know, like we do now. And so I remember taking in the pretend phones, but now I just use my cell phone for that. And don't kids grab your cell phone, Kate, and put it to their ears like they're going to call or make a call or talk.
Well, you know, until recently I was not a take my phone in, but now that I have the fancy phone, the stupid thing overheats in the car, so I guess
yeah.
I'm going to have to start using my real phone with kids because they it gets so hot in the car, it like goes into lock mode. So
yeah.
I don't know. I've never been a take my phone person in, but I think I might have to start.
Well, you know, I had so many. I've had little family emergencies that
right.
Not every time I would leave my phone in the car would be when a kid would break a bone and I would
my
get back to the
my kids are a little older. I figure it can wait an hour. Whatever emergency it is, it can wait an hour. But my phone can't withstand the heat, so I'm going to have to start doing that. I have.
Well, I'll tell you, I never took my phone in until 9/11, and then I got in the car. And Johnny had called me like 19 times,
oh.
And that's the day. I mean, that since then.
You've had to have your phone, huh?
Yeah, and I really have had lots of times where the phone, it might have dropped between the seats or for some reason I didn't take it in, and those were always the times that I would get the call from the school. You know, Mrs. Mize, your child is blah, blah, blah. You know, there's no answer at your home number. We're hoping that someone will be able to come to school. And then you feel like a loser parent because, you know, it's been an hour and nobody's called back. So I take my phone. But back to what we're talking about with the automatic actions with objects, that's something lots of children will instinctively do because they see their parents with the phones to their ears. So that might be something that you could get a child to imitate.
Haven't you had a lot of kids, Laura, that, and this isn't necessarily related, but it made me chuckle. A lot of kids who will use everything they get as a phone.
Yeah.
And they, like, they've overlearned that. Oh, you put it to your ear
yeah.
thing. I find myself at some point saying, it's not a phone. You know?
Well,
you know, they have
it
them for the ball toy and they put it to their ear. You give them the, you know, whatever it is, and
yeah.
they put it to their ear. It's like, well, Mom thought this was cute when I did it with the pretend phone or her cell phone, so that's what they do with everything. I always say, it's not a phone. Come on.
You're not praising their symbolic representation skill.
No, not. And maybe initially I think, oh, he's pretending it's a phone. But when I begin to realize he pretends everything is a phone, I'm not as enamored with the behavior, no.
Well, I don't even know quite what to say about that. I think it depends on the context about
yeah.
whether. But if a kid were doing it perseveratively, you would start to say,
"Okay,
come on now,
that.
You know, let's get a new trick." Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Let's try a new action with that object. All right.
Here's
so
one I do a lot of is trying to get kids to stick things on their heads to see if
yeah.
they have a clue on like a bucket on their head, and I pretend it's a hat, and then I see if they can do it.
Well,
some
that's
can.
The next thing. If you then you try to make a child or get a child or facilitate or entice, whatever better verb you want to use other than make, is do a novel action with an object. So that's perfect. That would be your next little step in your hierarchy to see if he could use, if he could imitate using an object in a novel way. So a bucket on your head. He's probably not ever done that until crazy old Kate had him do it, huh? But that's a good example. That's a good example of that. You might have him with a hat. You might have him try to sit on a hat or try to roll a cup or pat a ball or something that he might not have ever done before, because then you know that he's really imitating versus, oh, he would have done that action with, he would have rolled that car anyway because that's what's expected. He knew to do that.
Like
so you
banging
take
two blocks together. Sometimes you'll do it,
yeah.
and they do it, and then you see as you're with them, you know, maybe the initial time, oh, he really kind of bangs everything together.
Everything,
you know,
that, yeah.
It wasn't just imitating me. It was that's the action he has, is banging things.
Right, right. So that would be the next little step that you want to do is have them imitate those more novel actions, and it is a good – your point is well taken with, but you want to be sure that it's something that he wouldn't have done anyway, or that he, that's not his one big move that he does all the time. So you look at that. Then if a child is doing all of that with you, if they're imitating some of those early gestures, you know, that children would learn between 6 to 12 months, and then we had to imitate some actions and play with their own bodies, and if that were hard for them, we would look at imitating simple expected actions with objects, and then we talked to just now about how to do more novel objects or more novel actions with objects. What do you do next? Then you bump it up so that the child is imitating some nonverbal actions, but with his mouth. And by this, again, your focus here is on him learning to use his mouth in imitation of you, but again, he's not there yet where he can't really imitate any real words, and he can't really imitate any of those almost words or exclamatory words that are a lot easier to say. There's a step kind of in between there where you would have him imitate some actions that don't necessarily involve any words or vocalizations, like kissing a baby doll, or, you know, I do air kisses all the time. Do you do that, Kate, where you're pretending to kiss something, but you don't really kiss it, the kind of smack?
Yeah,
thing.
Oh, yeah.
The kid will do that, yeah.
I didn't know it was called an air kiss, though. I just call it a pretend kiss.
I don't think that's an official speech pathology term.
No,
I think that's
just
an everyday
air
kiss.
I didn't know
yeah.
I did it, but I do.
Yeah. And so, again, it's harder because he's imitating that nonverbal action with his mouth, but you're moving him in the right direction. So air kisses would be a thing to do. What about pretending when you're playing with the baby dolls and you're pretending to have them eat? Don't you do a little kind of an eating sound? Yeah, that would be something.
The mandatory,
yeah.
That's the bottle after they drink it. I have a number of kids that the minute I get out a bottle or we start that sucking something down, they do that.
Yeah, that's a great one. That's a great one to do. Mm-hmm. Other kinds of things might be trying to imitate blowing. And again, you're not doing the blowing from a lot of speech pathologists. And when I went to school, that was the big thing is, you know, would blowing and sucking really help to a kid learn how to talk if he didn't know how to blow or if he didn't know how to suck? How would that, those feeding skills really translate into speech skills? And the research is pretty clear on that. Blowing, when you practice blowing and sucking, you learn how to blow and suck better, but you don't learn how to talk better. But the reason that you would try to get a kid to imitate blowing would be just for him to learn how to imitate anything. And so it's not necessarily the blowing that's the part. It's the oral imitation piece that would be important with that. So blowing, I make pretend birthday cakes out of Play-Doh all the time and make my little candle. Do you do that, Kate?
I actually have, no, I don't do Play-Doh. I have a Velcro set of food that has a pretend cake that has candles that they don't light up, obviously, but they do stay up, and if you blow them, they go down. So I usually do it with that.
Pretty cool.
That's a pretty cool one.
I have a new birthday toy that I don't think we've even talked about this toy before, Kate. It is a set that it has a little dog that looks like Clifford on the top. Have you seen this toy before?
Oh, I have that. And the hair comes out of the head?
No.
Okay.
It's a little Clifford. He's on the top of a birthday cake, but there's a little magic wand thing that lights up. And when you touch the tip of the candle, it looks like it lit the candle.
Oh.
It's really cute. The thing is, though, it's hard to do. I mean, I had to practice the first day that I got it because I couldn't always make it. I couldn't always get the little tip of the magic little wand star thing to touch exactly on the candle where it was supposed to touch. And I just used it with my little friend, Emma Kate, who just turned 3. And she got pretty mad because it didn't just automatically light up. You know, I wish they had made it so that the light would have come on when you just touched any part of the wand. But of course they didn't ask me what would really work with with toddlers. But it's a pretty cute set. I ordered it from Amazon. Of course, I can never remember what the real name of the toy is.
It's made by Play-Doh, though, right? So.
No. It's not.
Oh.
It's not made by Play-Doh. Play-Doh. I make just little birthday cakes, like, you know, make a little circle and use a cookie cutter or whatever, and then make a little pathetic looking almost candle thing, and then I'll take a little piece of yellow and put it on top to make, you know, pretend like it's like we lit the candle. That's what I do with the Play-Doh, but this is a separate toy. I'm sorry, I should have clarified that better. But anyway, pretending to blow out candles, that's another good motor thing that toddlers would like to do. I used to be better about taking real candles and lighting them and let children pretend like there was a birthday party that way. I haven't done that in a long time. I had a little boy one time leaned so far in that I really thought he burned his mouth, and I thought, okay, I'm done with that.
You're done with that. I still take them for third birthdays.
Yeah.
But I'm very cautious about, like, really making sure they, because some of them, even by three, don't really have an instinct to be afraid of it. Yeah, they'll go right for it.
I know. Well, and this, the little boy that happened with, that was when we had our play group. Johnny just chuckled because he remembers that day, because that was the only day that I ever openly
cursed. No more
cursed.
Candles.
It scared me, though. I'm, you know, very scared and said a horrible word, you know, as I'm diving across the table, and as, you know, the parents are watching on Playgroup TV from the lobby, and then, you know, hearing me, I think everybody was just shocked that I said that word, and then to hear the laughter from the lobby after everybody realized the kid was okay, and that I was just mortified enough to curse in front of young children. It was one of my finer moments. I can't even believe I'm saying it on there. Anyway, let's move on. I'll have to figure out what the name of that birthday party, that birthday cake is. Maybe Johnny can find it for me. But it's kind of cute. But
I bet Google Clifford birthday cake and you'd get it.
I don't think it's really Clifford, though.
Oh,
it's just a red dog on top that it's Clifford-like, but it's not a Clifford brand.
Okay.
It's like a K&K toy or something like that, but it's cute. But here's the other part. Here's the point I've been trying to get to for 5 minutes. You can blow the candles, and they will really go out. So you blow the little lights, and
that's
so it's
cute.
Kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of cool. Johnny ran and got it out of my toy stash.
Aww.
And the cake, I forgot about this part. The cake is Velcro, so you can really cut the pieces apart.
Oh, they love that Velcro cutting.
Yeah, but the material, it's my singing birthday cake, and I do think it's a K&K toy. And, boy, I need the readers to look at those, look at this to get it. But, anyway, it's pretty cute, but I did like it because it's
that sounds cute.
That's okay, Johnny. It's pretty cute. But that would be something you could do. Hot foods are, you know, again, a popular thing that you could have moms kind of practice at. And, again, you're not really going to make him a better blower. You're just trying to get him to imitate anything with his mouth. I have kids try to do things like if we're playing with the farm, like lick, like the kitty cat would lick, you know, where they might stick their tongues out and do that, and toddlers think that's hysterical, or click their tongue, like if when we have a horse and the horse is walking, the do you do that one too?
I don't do that.
But
good
anything
one,
that they what'd you say?
I said it's a good one though. I like it.
Yeah.
I
so any
it,
little
though.
Movement like that you could have them do. So that would be see if he can do
I'm
that.
I'm not
and
sure
work.
I can do that actually. So I'm not sure I'll have to be able to put that into my repertoire. How are you doing it?
Just put your tongue and let's see how can I lift your tongue up to the roof of your mouth and kind of pull it back a little bit and then just kind of have
plucking
suction
your tongue
there.
Like?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You can do it like that, but I do it kind of I don't know, I'll have to show you. We'll have to have a little face-to-face.
Yeah.
But, yeah, just clicking your tongue would work fine, too.
That I can do, but I don't know that other thing.
That other sound.
That other sound, huh?
I think kids, I bet you do. I bet kids have done that other sound, too. Other things that you might do are kind of your surprised face. Don't you do that, Kate, where you do a big,
boy,
ooh.
And I love it when my kids get it and use it. You know, it's like, oh, so cute.
So cute. Do you remember that little boy we see that would laugh and your...
He became a great imitator. I said, quit imitating my laugh. He was so, it was so fake and it was so exaggerated, but it was so me at the same time.
But it was so you.
Like, oh, he's
every
doing
time
me.
He did it, every time he did it, I would just crack up because I would think, oh my gosh, he's doing Kate.
but I do remember him.
But that happens. That's great. I mean, he really learned how to imitate your affect and imitate all those little nonverbal things that we do. So that was great. And he did use that communicatively. When he would pretend, when something was funny, he would go to doing Kate. Yeah, so he used it functionally, too. All right, so that's what you do next. You look, you work on having him imitate those actions with his mouth that aren't necessarily verbal. Then what you do is add that next little step where you start to have them do vocal actions with their mouth, but we're still not quite at words yet. This would be like panting like a dog. And a lot of kids on my caseload, if you say to them, what does the dog say? They do instead of woof, 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 because that's an early little almost word, almost sound vocalization that I can get kids to do pretty early on, and that's kind of one of my standards. You do panting too, don't you?
I do, but I don't necessarily associate. I mean, I'll do the doggy's hat, but I don't usually, like I would probably, I'm not saying I'm right here, Laura, but I could hear myself saying, no, he says, whoop, whoop, whoop.
But see, I think it's so easy to get a pant as kind of an early imitation. And, you know, I've gotten pretty darn focused about, okay, every kid I have that's not talking, I'm going to see if I can systematically walk them through this process. And so I think I've trained myself that that's something I do
before
with almost every.
On, whiff.
Yeah. Yeah, and so that's just kind of one of my go-to things. And it is a pretty easy thing to get a kid to do. They always think it's funny.
Right.
I mean, I've never not had a kid, not, you know, really not pay attention to that. Or, you know, if they're really kind of socially connected and cognitively with it, that again, they laugh and laugh because they think that's hysterical. And it is an early imitation that you can get when a kid really can't do anything else. He can, you know, if he's ready, if he's at the point where he can, you know, he's done a lot of things, a lot of motor imitation, this is a good one, kind of an in-between thing if you still have those kids that aren't quite ready to imitate words yet. Panting like a dog is a good thing to do. Audible inhalation when you're surprised or happy, and I do that all the time, like, you do that, don't you? That kind of reverse gasp.
Yeah.
That's a good one to do. Screaming would be a good thing to do. And I always use screaming in the context of row, row your boat because of that cute little second verse, you know, row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. If you see an alligator, close your eyes and scream, ah! And that's an early one that you can get lots of kids, even kids that are young, you know, your 18-month-olds, your 20-month-olds that you're getting. That's certainly something that they would try to do kind of early on. Fake coughing.
I do that one with I'm scared. And kids love that. Like with the blocks, like if I have a worm or a snake or a bug in there, I always pretend that they're scary. And I do. And I have one little girl that so associates it with me. She's moved away. She's pretty verbal now. But when I get there, she says, hi. And I put my hands on my face. And I know she's basically saying, hi, Kate. You know what I mean? Like, she's so...
That's your
so
name.
With me. Yeah, for a little while, early on, that's about all she did. No matter what you were modeling or what you were doing, it was, you know, but now she's made great progress and moved way past it. But she did it just the other day, and her mom said, oh, she hasn't done that in so long. Well,
she's pulling out her oldie but goodie.
Yeah. For a little while, Mom thought I'd ruined her, and that was all she was ever going to do. Because, boy, it was. And she's one of those very animated, very cute little things, itty bitty, preemie, and now she's 2.5 and doing pretty well. But for a while, that is about all she did. And I was like, ooh, I hope you're not right.
I know. I know some parents don't really appreciate that imitating a scream.
I will say she does it in a cute way. She puts her little hands on her cheeks just the way I do it. But I was a little concerned for a week or two. Maybe I shouldn't have taught that one because she sure loved it.
Oh, that's cute.
But when she used it for my hello the other day, and she's, like I said, she's way past that now. But it was cute that she pulled it out for me.
Oh, she remembered.
No, she's very smart in her way. So.
Oh,
anyway,
that's
it was cute.
Other things here, blowing raspberries would kind of also fall under this category, the thing. Laughing with your hand to your mouth, we've already talked about how fond our little friend was of you when you would do that. Pretending to cry, oh boy, that's a big one, isn't it? Fake crying, oh, lots of kids love that. I do it with the babies all the time. I do it if I think that they might sort of be getting close to crying or having a tantrum and I want to do everything I can to prevent that, I might fake cry as a way to kind of avert that. And the first few times you do it, they're so surprised you really can redirect them from crying themselves because they're so shocked that you've done that. So pretending to cry is a good one. What about this one? I'm sure you do it all the time. Shh, for quiet.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, and sometimes it's funny, kids will get one part of, you know, they can put their little fingers to their mouths, but sometimes they're not doing anything beyond that. You know, they can't do the SH sound there or don't really do anything. I remember one little guy that he would put his finger right there and go, oh, because he knew he was supposed to do something vocally. But he couldn't quite get that little mouth going for shh. So he would go, oh, and I was like, man, that defeats the whole purpose. Yeah. But he imitated his little finger to his mouth, so that was great. Pretending to sleep where you're snoring, that's a funny one to do for toddlers. We've already talked about the slurping noise, well, the drink noises, you know, the after, and I also do the but drinking too, that's a fun one to do. Shivering, you know, when I do scared, I don't really do screaming for scared. I do whoo, and like it almost like a that kind of thing, and I have a lot of kids do that. Or in the, you know, the Indian noise, like the whoo, that might be a good one to try there too. So that's how you would bump them up from that next little phase. When you had them doing things with their mouths that weren't necessarily vocal, then you would move them to imitating vocal actions with their mouths. Then once you get kids doing that, you can move into those exclamatory words or play words. And we talk about these words all the time, like, uh-oh, our animal noises, our car sounds, little words like, yay. Don't you wish you had a dollar for every time you said that in the course of a week or a month? Yeah.
I heard a dad last week say to me, and this is a little guy, he has an older brother who's on the spectrum, and he's fairly delayed but doesn't really seem to have any spectrum-y tendencies. But last week the dad said to me, he sure loves that yay thing.
But it's easy to imitate. It's pretty functional, meaning that, you know, you can use it like a real word, like, I'm happy, that's so great, woo, you know, yay. So that's a great word. That's a great word to find.
It didn't discourage me anyway. It was just kind of funny. The dad's attitude, I was like, oh, well. He did
that.
And he's already made some progress, so that was, I mean, that's good, but he was funny
about
it.
That is good.
Okay,
yeah,
well, let's say on this lady's... Oh, go ahead.
Well, and other little exclamatory words like wow, boom, ouch, whoops. I do the woohoo all the time. Woohoo! Any little noises like that.
I do
that would kind
of, a lot.
Yeah, me too.
Anything moving or sliding or, you know.
Yeah.
That's a wee, which can be hard because so many of these kids have problems with that long E sound, but... If they can, I always kind of like to know, can they get it? Can they do it yet?
I know.
Mm-hmm.
I know. And, you know, that word, we, really is used kind of in the next level where we talk about establishing verbal routines. And that would be where you are taking your toys and you're being pretty purposeful about the kinds of words that you model when you're playing with a particular toy. And like you just said, anytime you're going to make a toy slide or swing or move in kind of that playgroundish way. It's, or I bet you do it too when a car goes down the ramp. Is that when you say it too?
I do something, yeah, depending on the kid and where they are and what I'm focused on. But yeah, I use it a lot.
I use it a lot too. Other ones would be, and everybody does this one, where words like where you're trying to get go. So you say ready, set, go. And again, you're establishing that verbal routine where you're going to say the same patterns and use your same little core set of words to really get a kid so familiar with that word in that routine that he almost just pops it out before he even has a chance to consciously think about it. That happens too when when moms who are counters, moms that who do the 1, 2, 3 instead of ready, set, go. Don't you have a lot of kids that you'll hear them, you say one and they go, ooh, for three. And so again, you're building that automatic speech. You're using your verbal routines to establish those first little word imitations. And we talked about that a lot last week with getting lots of routines and being really purposeful and using all that theory that you learned in school, in grad school, with establishing those early words through that core vocabulary. So that would be the next kind of words, or the next little rung up the ladder, the next set of your goals that you're going to work on, or words like that kind of that are automatic in speech. And then you'll probably start to hear some real word imitations with more functional words after you get kids imitating those other kinds of words first. Okay, I think you had an important point to make.
It may only be important to me, so if anybody's listening and this doesn't mean anything to them, please forgive me. But, Laura, I take advantage of our hourly podcast to learn as I'm listening and talking. And I just wanted to ask you, I have to say, I have not seen many kids in 12 years of late talkers who did what she describes, where they're using vowel sounds but no consonant sounds. I've certainly had lots of kids who did the for everything.
And she's saying he has correct vowel sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And I have seen this pattern, and I don't know if you remember one of my little guys that was on the Apraxia DVD, a little redheaded boy named Max. I know his mom wouldn't care if I talk about him like this. He got to the point he could do some consonants. And again, you don't really want to work on consonants in isolation, because he could do a lot of consonants by themselves, because he could make a car go and go, you know, or pretend he was doing a gun and do, you know, all day long.
Right.
But he couldn't sequence it with a vowel to use real words. And so he had a couple hundred of different words before he consistently used consonants. And he might pop out a consonant here or there in a word, or say a word perfectly one time, but then the next time he said it, it would just be back to those vowels. I mean, he was really apraxic. And that's what it sounds like to me is going to happen for this
little
guy.
But, Lord, did it take you a while to get him to that stage
he
was even using the vowels?
What's happened is this little boy just isn't as severe. He probably has just some milder motor planning things. And so she gets there. And again, I know some of you or some speech pathologists might say, how in the world would you ever say a little boy who's not even two yet, you know, why in the world would you use a term like apraxia? Well, because look at him. He can't imitate. He can't do, you know, combine consonants and vowels together. It sounds like anything. His only consistent vocalization is mom, and I would bet the M is not on the end consistently. Or I don't know. He might have it there. He might. But really, because that's such an atypical pattern of development, I mean, that's what I would start to think about a little guy like this.
Right.
Now, if this were
I've seen kids like get there, but not when I get them. Honestly, if I got a kid like that, from the get-go, I think, ooh, we've got a lot to work with. You know,
I would too. Because he's only 20 months.
Right.
Yeah, he's not quite 24 months.
So bad.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, compared to they're very quiet and do almost no vocalizing, or all they do is literally grunt. and that's all you hear is,
But
you know.
I think her point is she thinks, okay, this is a little boy that's got all these foundational pieces in place. How can I move him along really quickly?
Right.
And I just gave her that recipe. And again, it doesn't work like clockwork, but it is pretty consistent, and that's how I've worked with kids for a long time now. No matter what their, you know, whether I think it's apraxia, whether it's a phonological disorder, meaning that, you know, he doesn't, you know, he hasn't processed, you know, if you, you know, if you kind of look at the theories there, you know, he's, he knows the words, he's just not, you know, again, kind of from a processing perspective, able to get those consonants in the right places. You know, who knows what his diagnosis will end up to be. He's not even two. That's not even important at this point. Yeah. It's just, and she's not even concerned about
what's
wrong.
No, she's just saying, what do I do to help him?
Exactly. And so I think that she can take that whole hierarchy and move him from, and it sounds like he's got those foundational pieces in there because he's already learned some signs, and he, you know, she said his receptive language is good. She didn't say anything that his play stinks, and that's usually what it looks like when a kid who can't imitate motor actions, they don't play very well. They don't have good play skills usually. So she didn't say that about him.
Like just interest, and I think a lot of times as much as, in a way, they are disinterested because it's just so difficult for them. That
they're not
kind
good
of,
at it,
They're not good. And the things that are normally, you know, really intriguing and exciting for a little guy, for him, it's just painfully hard work, so they really don't show much interest. And it's always nice to see once they get a little bit more practice and ability, oh, look at all these toys he loves, you know.
Right. But parents do misread that, and sometimes therapists even misread it. They'll think, oh, it's not exciting enough, it's not complicated enough. And I always think, and you are so good about saying this and saying, no, it's too hard. It's got to be simple. It's got to be basic. You know, don't go for the whole, you know, he's doing solving algebraic equations in that little mind. And, you know, I'm not saying that those kids don't actually turn out to be smart further down the road. It's just usually from a motor perspective, they can't coordinate their little bodies well enough to play. And so it does look like they're blowing things off, like they don't like anything, like they only want to sit and watch hours and hours of TV.
Because they can't. Yeah, and I do kind of explain to parents, we all like to do things we're good at. And when it's really, really a little challenge is one thing, but when it's a huge effort to do something, I think it's human nature to say, not worth it. I'm not that interested. Forget it. But then you see them, you know, a month or two or three or 4 months down the line, they just light up when you get the same toy out because now he can do it, you know, and it's like, woohoo, aren't I cool?
Yeah.
Just when it's that difficult to do something that's supposed to, and for most children is fun, is reinforcing, and they do want to keep doing it, if it's that darn difficult, not worth it.
And kids, a lot of times like this, I mean, they might use a toy in a repetitive, stereotypical kind of way, where if it's, you know, they might have only kind of mastered that one big movement of opening and closing, so consequently that's all they want to do is sit and open and close that door over and over and over again because he can't make himself do much of anything else. Or you'll have the kids that kind of, they're always flipping the toys over on the back, and parents always say, oh, my goodness, it's going to be an engineer. He's trying to figure out how to take that battery out. And I'm thinking, that's not it. He doesn't know how to play. He doesn't know how to use it. His, you know, again, it might have some visual kind of stereotypical things, too, kind of lumped with that. But so many times people do miss it that they can't play. It's not that they won't play or that they're purposely choosing not to do those motor things. They don't know how to do it yet. But her little guy doesn't sound like he's going to have that problem. I think she's going to be able to take these steps and really move him through that process, but she's got to begin at a place where he can be successful, and that usually is with the motor imitation and and then kind of moving him on through that continuum. Lots of those nonverbal actions with, her, you know, she's going to do it, and then he's going to do it in play. And again, you don't put a two-year-old on the table and say, okay, now's the time where this is the time for the oral imitation portion of our therapy session. Mm-hmm. No, you do it in play. You do it in play, like we talk about every week on here.
She jokes about that, but there are therapists who do that. And it's not nearly as much fun that way.
No,
no way. Don't get much response because it's like, what? You know, it's not really fun then presented that way.
Yeah, it's got to be in place. So that is from the new therapy book, Teach Me to Talk, the Therapy Manual. And it's got a long second title that I can barely remember myself. I think it's The Comprehensive Guide to Treating Receptive and Expressive Language Delays in Toddlers and Young Preschoolers. I said it. I've remembered it. So you can check that out on the website. It is officially for sale. And, again, if you sent me an email and got a coupon code, that expires at midnight. So get that in, and that is doing really, really well. I'm so excited that so many people were excited about it and have emailed me, and we've sold a bunch of those overseas already, too, so that's been very exciting for me. I know. So, all right, we are here at the end of our hour. Any parting words, Kate, before we go?
No, at some point in the next week or two or three or whenever, I want to revisit that little girl that I talked about and you kind of helped me with.
Did help me with,
because I've had an interesting development with her in a good way, but it's not something I've seen much of, so I'm sure you've seen it more than I have. You've done lots more of this than I have, but so I want to just
really
bounce off.
You've really piqued my interest.
I know. It's a little
teaser.
I was going to ask, but our one question took the hour as usual.
I know.
So it's not a huge deal, but she is doing very well. And our speech therapist hasn't been able to see her through a series of, the mom has a new baby.
Unfortunate events.
So it's not about the speech therapist, but she just hasn't been able to see her yet. So anyway, it's good, but it's interesting to me, and I'm interested to hear what you have to say about it because it's not something –
I think as soon as we're done here, I'm not going to be able to wait till next week. I'm going to hang up and call you.
But
and
I always
find out what
like
that is.
To surprise you on air, so you have to respond. Like you
no!
did. What do you think, Kate? Have you had that happen? I'm
it's
sure
about
you
to be payback, isn't it?
It's just not something that maybe, you know, I don't know. It's not something I have seen happen very much. And in a way, it's good. It's just, it kind of makes me scratch my head and wonder, I wonder why this is working,
but I don't know
why it is, and I was just going to get and you may not know either. It may be to me it's somewhat atypical, but she's doing it and it's working for her, so, hey, I'm happy. I take whatever works. I'm not a purist about it. Why
not now?
If it works, I'm happy. So,
well, we
anyway.
Will start the show. We'll start the show with that next week, and then I think we have another couple of great emails that I want to get to, and then we have a caller. I don't know if I've told you about this, Kate. There's a speech pathologist who is in the Caribbean. She's in Barbados, and she is planning to call in several weeks because she has so many questions that she wants to ask about her really hard
count on some kind of accommodations there.
Maybe she'll fly us in personally to meet with her. Wouldn't that be fun?
There you go. Forget the podcast. We'll do it live.
I know, and you and I both, with our skin, will be under the umbrella so we don't break out or have any of our other freaky things happen.
Yeah,
but anyway, she's calling, and I think she said 3 weeks.
Oh, that'll
I think
be fun.
I know. She's got some church things going on Sunday nights, but she's going to be available in several weeks. So I'm so excited about that. But my point to this was, if you are a therapist or a mom and have a really specific question about your kid or a kid that you're working with, please send it to us because we love real-life scenarios and coming up with what we would recommend and what we would do. And it always makes me feel so much better when it's a real-life person that we can help. And so I would just love to get those emails. We did get an update, too, from our caller from a few weeks ago, Carrie from Virginia sent some good things, too, that have been happening in her session. So we'll try to review that next week as well. So, but anyway, thanks so much for the show tonight and for joining us. And we will be back here next Sunday night at 6 o'clock to do it all again.
Have a great week in Tennessee. I know you will.
Thanks. Okay. I'm going to call you. Bye.
Okay, bye.